this particular chapter, he spends a big portion of the time, both the writer in the first 12 verses, as well as the writer of the class book, Brother Adams, in emphasizing the benefits of friendship, how important friendship is. And he makes a note that we'll kind of allude to at the beginning, and it will come across again when we get on, I think, page 18, is that this chapter is often used to almost as a marriage manual, two are better than one, and such, and the benefits of partnership. And that's certainly applicable in this to the marriage relationship. What kind of friend you should be to your spouse, and so on and so forth. But that we don't want to give short shrift to this chapter by thinking exclusively in one area with regard to relationships. That these can be impactful in so many different places, in so many different ways, and with regard to the workplace and friendship in general, and the benefits that we can show one another as we have a kinship and a concern for one another spiritually in the church as well. So there are a lot of different applications that can be made with regard to these things, and we want to kind of open our minds to those possibilities. So if you'll notice, he starts off with the statement of the summary that's found in verses 9 and 10. Concerning friendship, he says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor, for if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And so the idea of companionship and the benefits of companionship is what's under consideration in this text. It's a very, very beneficial chapter. I really enjoyed the study and preparation for it. I think it's going to be helpful to us. So let's start off by noting his introductory comments talk about the tendency that we have in our society today to be somewhat isolated from others. It's partly because of technology, and that's what he emphasizes in this place. Now, one of the things that I've found interesting just in the last 10-12 years is become more aware of the different character traits that people have. Some people are extroverted, some people are introverted. And we've got a group of Christians here at Westside, maybe a little bit larger percentage than is typical in a congregation, that trend toward the extreme introverted side. Now, you might not be aware of them particularly, or at least consider how extreme they're the way they are as far as they're being introverted. But I've had enough conversations with enough of them to know that that's the case. And the one of the reasons why is because they do make a real strong effort to be sociable, especially when they're here at Westside. But it takes a lot out of them to do that. And so I'm mindful of the different personality traits that can be impactful of this as well. It's all right to be an introvert. It's all right to be an extrovert. But there are drawbacks to being that. I mean, an extrovert can get on the nerves of introverts for one. It happens quite a bit, actually. And introverts can seem to others to be unsociable and sometimes unfriendly. And so what we have to do is to, and I think this is the case with any aspect of our lives as Christians, we have to be mindful of two things. Number one, if we've got a particular tendency or personality trait that might govern the way we conduct ourselves and act, we've got to be aware of how that character trait that we have might be standing at odds with what God's Word expects of us as Christians. In other words, each of us sometimes have things that we have to overcome in order to be acceptable to God. And it again has to have to do with our personality. And this is something the Bible actually mentions on a number of occasions. For example, with regard to elders are to be slow to anger. well, being slow to anger is something that should be present in every Christian's life. But the idea with regard to the qualification of elders is you need some individuals who have actually mastered that to serve as elders, because they're going to be provoked. And some Christians, I know I could give you a list of a dozen elders who have had in their lives a quick temper that they've had to overcome. In other words, they had to gain mastery of that so that they do not act inappropriately. And I'll give you just one example. Go a little far afield, but I think it helps set this. Had an elder in Tucumcari, New Mexico. I was fortunate, the very first congregation where I preached, where there were two men who were serving as elders of that small congregation. And a conflict arose. And we were sitting in my office with the two elders and the man who had the conflict. And we were trying to reason through it. And elders being very patient with him and very kind with him in dealing with it. He was an older man as well, but he was upset. And as a part of the discussion, he brought up a flare of temper from one of the elders that he said disqualified him to serve. You ought not to be serving as an elder because you're quick to anger. And at that time, I said, well, when did this happen? And it was over 30 years previous when it happened. And he had been harboring that. But the fact was that the elder had a quick temper. I mean, he was, and he had worked through it. And he was acting exactly the way an elder should act at this point in time. But it was something he had to overcome. And so, that's something that has happened. So with regard to being an extrovert, for example, one of the typical qualities of extroverts is sometimes they can speak before they think. Or sometimes they can be almost overbearing to other individuals as they want to help, they want to be friendly, they can be intrusive. And that can be something that is detrimental to relationships. And so they have to be mindful of their tendencies, mindful of who it is that they're interacting with, so that they don't cause more harm than good in their efforts to do good. Introverts, however, since they have that tendency to isolate themselves, and they are willing to be isolated because they're comfortable in their isolation, well, there are plenty of admonitions that are given in Scripture concerning the need to be mindful of your brother, to be concerned and express that concern by action, encouragement, and others. And so it's necessary for introverts to sometimes overcome their tendencies in order to fulfill the requirements that God has given them. And I think that's kind of the theme of this first section, is the fact that we isolate ourselves. Technology, again, plays a part. He talks about the fact that you can see this with regard to kids especially, but it's, I'm seeing it more and more with adults and even older adults, to where you're together, but you're on your phone. And you're together, but you're doing things. And I saw on computer just yesterday, I think it was, an image. It showed two young ladies back in the 1930s or 40s in the period of dress or whatever it was, and they were sitting on the front porch and they were reading books. And they were ignoring each other because they were sitting there reading books together. So that was kind of saying, hey, it's always been this way, but it's really not always been this way. There's a little bit of difference between sitting and reading a book together and ignoring each other when you're eating because you're on your phone instead of talking to the person in front of you. There's a big difference with regard to those things. And there's that tendency for isolationism. And there's a problem with being isolated, is that, number one, you're not there to help someone else, which we'll talk about is an important part of this. And number two, if you need help, often individuals do not know about it, or individuals are less inclined to be helpful to you because there has not been that social interaction that that has maybe established those bonds and strengthened those bonds. So there are some problems with the idea of isolating oneself, and the concept of friendship and the benefits of it is kind of the central concept of what we're talking about.
I was going to say, when you were talking about like the two little girls sitting there, now you'll have two people sitting next to you texting one another, but they're not looking at one another, and that contact is what makes you kind of see sometimes the need what that other person has, because you can read something on a paper, but you can tell by facial expression. I've often been glad that somebody will make a comment sometimes where they don't see my reaction, because it'd be hard to hide it.
Yeah.
But that is a problem. We don't interact with one another in that way. So.
So this, I think, will be helpful because there are kind of those tendencies. And one of the things that we need to strive for as Christians, especially in the relationships that we have, the spiritual relationships we have with one another, is to develop those, be there for one another, and to recognize the benefits of that kind of a friendship. So that is an interesting, though it's an interesting kind of outgrowth of technology, because I am absolutely amazed at how able I am to be in contact with individuals in a sense. In other words, you think about the way we had to, if we had sickness or a surgery, that emergency surgery or death or something like that, and how we had to let everyone know about that. We had phone call chains that we put together as a congregation where we go through and, okay, you call A through D and you call E through, you know. And there were times when things came up and we didn't have those in place where Debbie and I spent, you know, a couple of hours on the phone getting a hold of everyone we could, and then having to, fill in the blanks when we could because we couldn't get a hold of everyone. Where now, I send out text to Facebook and it gets almost everybody. It doesn't get everybody, unfortunately, but a lot of times that's their own fault because they've got a phone where I could text them and they don't sign up.
It takes me out.
But the thing is that ability and the fact that, like in the sermon last night, while Armando was getting prepared, Debbie was at home and not feeling well, but she wanted to listen to the sermon. And so she got on Facebook and the live stream came up of the sermon audio, and she listened to Armando's sermon from home while it was happening. It wasn't something she had to do later or anything like that. She could actually listen to it now. And that's it's something we're taking for granted. It's just there, and wow, this is, you know, just the way it is. But if you had dropped that ability down 30 years ago today, you know, you'd be preaching and everyone who wants to could hear it while it's happening, even though they're not there. They would have looked at you like you were from outer space. And so it's kind of a neat thing that ability is there. But the big important thing about this concept of friendship and relationships and such is the face-to-face, the interaction. It's hard to develop a relationship on Facebook or on the internet or through texting. And that kind of tends to isolate us. We can think we've got friends when we're by ourselves in a dark room and never interacting with anyone. And that's kind of the sad existence. It's certainly not what's described here in the scripture. Since we're kind of going off the deep end here, but another thing that irritates me is the idea that people have when they're interacting using technology, various social media sites and such, is that they actually are friends when that's all that relationship is an occasional text, a snarky comment, a liking of a video that's funny, or those kinds of things, that's what constitutes friendship. One of the things that I do on my Facebook account is I use it, probably the only reason I would be on there, because if I didn't do this, I don't think I would be on Facebook, but to send my sermons out and articles and those kinds of things and have those available in my newsfeed. So as a result of that, if anyone wants to be my Facebook friend, I always accept them. And as of late, I would say 85 to 90% of the request to be my Facebook friend has come from preachers and others from foreign lands, from the Philippines, India. They're just Pakistan. There are a lot of different places, Ethiopia, places like that. And so they asked to be my friend, and because I think, okay, the reason you're doing it, number one, is because you saw me as a friend to one of your friends, and so you're asking. That's the only reason they would find me. But secondly, I've got some things that you might benefit from, because these are usually Christians that are doing it. Well, but there's a reason why they're doing those things. Most of them, in fact, is that they're very, very poor. And by cultivating friendship with brethren in the States, there's a possibility that they might in some way be helped financially. And most of these are like members of liberal churches and things like that, and engaged in activities that I couldn't in good conscience be a part of, that I'm thinking, you know, some of my teaching might help them to come out of that. So I put them on the list. But I don't know how many times that as soon as I said, yes, I'll be your Facebook friend, that they send me a personal text acting like they've known me forever, you know, and how much they love me and care for me and so on and so forth. And just an over-the-top type thing. It's not an expression of brotherly love. It's a real cloying desire to be to act like we're good buddies. It's just not there. That relationship isn't there. And so Facebook friends are not friends. Facebook friends means that you hit a like button so that they can see your stuff and you can see their stuff, and that's all that means. Now you may have some really good friends that are on Facebook, but it's not the same thing. And I'm afraid that with especially a generation growing up to where that's second nature. And there are others. And by the way, Facebook is for old people. Did you know that? It is. Facebook is for old people because the young people have already gotten rid of stop that. I mean, they've got their Facebook accounts, but they don't go to Facebook. They go to Twitter and Snapchat and Snapchat and Instagram. Snapchat is the big one. And the one, you know why they do that? It's because those things don't stay on. You post them and they last for 15 minutes and they're gone. Yeah, and there's no way to get in the back. And they like that. I mean, the young people like that because there's no lasting evidence of what they put up unless somebody did the screen capture. So those kinds of things are going on. But yeah, whenever we do our ads and such for the church and we get responses, it's almost always from the ages of 40 and up. And even though we don't specify the demographic, in other words, I want people of all ages to look at and view the ad and consider coming or whatever, we don't get ever any responses from people below 40. It's always the older people. And so Facebook has kind of become grandma's, and the kids know that, so they stay away from it. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But anyway, all of that's out there. The kids are all, this is second nature to them. So they consider that. There's one Christian father, and I forget now who it was that did this, but he mentioned that he had been, that they were driving in the car, and he had a bunch of kids in the car with him. And they were in the car together and texting each other.
That's really common.
Yeah, that's weird. You'd say, we don't understand that, but that's there. So anyway, that's kind of what he's talking about. I could go all day with the anecdotes with regard to those things, but it's a problem. And so one of the things he mentions at the top of the next page is in chapter 1 and verse 9, there's nothing new under the sun. And so that this actually has been present, this concept of being isolated. It's just getting worse. But he mentioned that basically Solomon was a loner as well. And I think that there is something to do with his position. It's you're alone when you're the king. You have underlings, but it's difficult to have friends and confidants. And he mentions here that Solomon was like many who reach the top of the pyramid. When they find they're at the top, then there's not much room there for anybody else. So room to share. And so he's talking, and remember this, and look at these things. He's talking from first-hand experience. The book of Ecclesiastes is very much experiential. It has reference to the things that he did and tried. And the benefit of that is that since they have already been done and tried, then we can learn from them without having to go through the painful process of doing them and trying them ourselves. And so hopefully we can learn from his ideas. Okay, so that's what I wanted to cover in the introduction. Anybody have any, because I didn't read that, I just kind of talked about it. Anything that you have in the first page to the top of page 17? Join that. Okay, then let's look then at the three observations. So this is an examination of how it is, what you have actually seen, and this problem that we're talking about of isolationalism and an individual who does not have a friend. So someone read for me, first of all, verses 1 through 3, if you will, please. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Laura, if you will, please.
1 through 3?
Uh-huh.
Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who were already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not not seen the evil work that is done under the sun.
All right, so this first section is not specifically with regard to being alone, but there is something to be said about being in a situation to where you have no help. So there is a feeling of isolation in that case. And that's certainly the predicament of the individual who is without power. Now, that's a relative term, because each of us, when we come up against certain circumstances, we feel oppressed, we feel powerless. And one of the primary reasons for this, and I think something that he specifically refers to here in this text, is because of the concept of authority, which is a needful thing, but the point that when individuals are in a position of authority or power, that often they become unresponsive to the needs of those who are dependent upon them. And so big government's that way. We have politicians up in Washington, politicians in Austin, politicians on the local level, and everywhere you go, there are individuals who have grievances against the government because of the fact that they're being oppressed. And I think that is an interesting thing. Again, I've become more aware of some things, again, because of social media, but that next door site, people in River Oaks are just up in arms right now because of the unresponsiveness of the city council to a number of issues. The primary one that's being talked about so often is the water, quality of the water, which I have to admit to the fact that I'm not a connoisseur of water. So even when it comes out of the faucet round, it doesn't smell real good. I hold my nose and drink it and go on my way. Debbie can't stand it. We've bought so much bottled water in the last year or so because of the quality of the water supply. But if I want a quick drink of water, I just put on the faucet and drink it down and go. You know, so there's a difference between how we are. But there's so many complaints. You know, the water is undrinkable. One lady said, not only can I not drink it, I can't give it to my pets. That's how bad it is. Well, that's an overstatement. But one of the problems with the River Oaks community is that the water bill each month is significantly higher than surrounding communities, Sampson Park, Fort Worth, other places. And the quality of the water has been under par to the extent of where they've had, you know, citations and notices from the bigger government about the changes that need to be made, bring it back into compliance, and they're working at it, but they're not going fast enough and they're not pleasing people. So people have this perception. The gutters aren't being cleaned out consistently because the sweeper isn't coming right around like it used to. The water problem as well, and there's a third one, I think, that I can't remember what now it is that they're so up in arms about. But then you go to the state, same type of thing, get to the government with the health issues. That's where it kind of comes to mind, where everybody I talk to, they talk about how horrible it is. I was talking to Steve Betty Locklear. She's got one kind of deal that's a little bit different, but with his insurance, it's almost doubling. He just got the notice that his insurance premium is almost doubling, and there's nothing you can do about it. And of course he works, his wife doesn't, well, she does substitute teaching, but Betty does, but you know that she's got a bad arthritic condition and not a whole lot that she can do, and he's just got a preacher salary, and now all of a sudden insurance is going up and almost doubling. So it's going up $350 a month. And nobody, what can you do about it? You don't have any relief. There's nothing. You can complain, but that's about all that happens because of the lack of that. Now, you double that to add to that the fact that many governments are oppressive. And there are times in the history of Israel to where the rich and those who are in positions of influence used their position in order to make the lives of the poor more difficult. And that's what he's talking about here. Those kinds of things are present. Anytime you've got individuals who are in power who are unrighteous, the individuals who get hurt are the ones who are without recourse. They're the ones who don't have that standing. They don't have that influence. They don't have that power. And he calls it the sad state of those living beneath the thumbprint of the mighty. In the text, I saw the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. Now, again, keep in mind the concept here with regard to the observations, because there's something that he gives with regard to advice and things that could help the situation. But recognize that we're talking about that point of view where God's not the picture. And you know, one of the big things that happens today is that people say, you know, the church needs to be helping the oppressed. And that in effect, what the mindset is that the ills of society, that it's the church's responsibility to take care of the ills of society. And the interesting thing is when you look at the New Testament, especially with regard to the church, it's obvious that that's not the case. It's not the intent. What the text tells us is, number one, because we are Christians, we are going to be in the minority, so we will be the oppressed. It tells us, secondly, as individuals, we need to express our love for others so that we need to do the very best we can to help those who are oppressed, help one another especially. We have a special responsibility for those who are suffering in the church to help each other. But that's an individual responsibility that you have by being a good person. Thirdly, the best way to help the way the world is to preach the gospel. And that's what the church's responsibility is. And so the church should not be either burdened with or preoccupied with trying to deal with the symptoms when they are exclusively and uniquely able to help cure the problem. I'm reminded of Naaman the leper. I use this illustration quite a bit to illustrate this point. Naaman the leper, you'll remember, had a slave girl who told him about the prophet. And so Naaman. And so when he heard about the prophet, he went to his king to get permission to go to the prophet. And the king sent a letter to the other king. The other king, which is the king of Israel, he got this letter and he said, "I can't help this guy. The king of Syria is trying to pick a fight with me. I can't help him." And Elijah said, "Wait a second, I can." And it wasn't Elijah, it was Elisha, wasn't it? Who was it?
I know, I always get those two confused.
Yeah.
I think it's Elisha.
Yeah, I think it's probably. But, you know, they let him come to me and he'll know there's a prophet in Israel. The point is that he had the ability to fix the problem when the king didn't. And in our society today, the one who has the answer to the problem of societal ills is the preacher, not the king. And that's not to elevate me in any way. It's the point is the individual is proclaiming God's word because God's word has the answers. The answer is Jesus. The problem is sin. And the only way that the problem is going to be solved is by individuals repenting of their sin and turning to Jesus. And if everybody on earth were Christians, faithful Christians, then the world would not need police. The world would need the structure that it has today, because the reason why those exist, the kings that are appointed in Romans 13 and the laws that exist are for the evildoers. It's to control those who are doing evil. If there's no one doing evil, then you don't have the need for those things. So that's the answer to the problem. And so, you know, what we're doing is the most important thing as far as helping society out. It's ineffectual because society's not willing to listen. And I recognize that. But we can save individuals out of those problems and those situations. But you know, this is the idea that people have, is they think that life is going to get better if we really work hard at dealing with the symptoms, when in reality, life is not fair and never will be. There will always be the rich who will oppress the poor. There will always be hardship and trouble because of evil men. And that will wax worse and worse. It'll never come to an end. And this is a bad, bad situation or circumstance. But this is the point of view that there's nothing beyond the grave. And so as we acknowledge and understand this, and this is kind of the point of the chapter, is that how do we deal with it? Well, the best way to deal with it is get help. So get a friend. And don't try to go alone. And that will help you through this time. But the second thing is, and this is the broad general theme of the book, is don't think of life as that which is lived just in the now. Think of the future. Think of the hope that you have. And it makes it more bearable and we know that justice will finally come in the end, and it is a spiritual thing rather than a physical thing. So those are kind of the things you have to keep in mind as you look at these kinds of circumstances and situations, because it's not going to go away. He saw this. He observed it. I saw these things. I recognize these things. He talks about in chapter 3 and verse 16, I have seen. Chapter 4, verse 1, I looked again. Chapter 4, verse 4, I have seen. And that's him. He's observing these things. And what he's observing is what we see every day as well. We've been talking about different examples of it. So when you look at that, it reaches the point, as stated in verse 3, it'd be best not to even be born. That's how bad it is or can be. And you see those kinds of horrible situations that people find themselves in. Now, this is cynicism, and we've talked about this. And again, he uses cynicism quite a bit. I told you last week that I'm not 100% on board with that term. I understand it, why he's saying it. But we talked about despair. And I think that despair rather than cynicism is the best description of the tone of the book. This is just horrible. And it's a horrible situation, and there's no real way of solving this problem on earth. And but then he says in John chapter 16:33 that the cynical conclusions are typical because God's not the focus of life. Because when Jesus was saying the same thing, look at all these bad things that are happening and these bad things are going to happen to you, he said, but be of good cheer. Talking about how the world is going to strive against you and how much oppression there's going to be, but be of good cheer because I have overcome the world. And so there is the mindset that we are to have as Christians. So yes, it's a bad, bad state that the world is in, and it's not going to get better, and there's going to be a lot of suffering, and you're going to suffer as a result of the badness that is there. But you can still be cheerful as you acknowledge and understand that God is in control, and that ultimately the unrighteous will be punished. It's a righteous thing with God to visit tribulation and wrath upon the ungodly and those who would persecute us, and he will give us rest. And that's where the joy comes. All right. Anything else about point one? Horrible oppression.
Wouldn't Solomon be talking about himself, though? Being king, wouldn't he be the oppressor? He was,
would he?
Really.
Yeah, he was. There you go. You can see it. And again, you know, when was the book written? I think that we can... It's hard to know exactly when Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. There are individuals who even claim it wasn't Solomon that wrote him at all. And again, the only reason that I have to say that it was is because self-reference in Ecclesiastes 1, and my view is that providentially there wouldn't be any misleading information there. In other words, it would be straightforward since the Holy Spirit's the one who actually pins these things. So I think you're absolutely right. You find what Solomon had, what he lost, and this indication seems to be here is that he lost his way and he came to some understanding. The thing is that when you look at the life of Solomon and such, there's no indication that there was a full restoration in his life, but there were lessons that he learned, and whether or not he ever really made everything right in his life, he at least came to this conclusion and came to this understanding. So it's hard to know. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book. It's difficult to fit it into the entirety of Solomon's existence and say, okay, at what point in time would this have been written, and what's the evidence that we find in the narrative to say that, okay, he did all of this bad stuff and then he realized that it was bad at this point in time and see that change, because I don't know that we can really see that in the narrative. But it seems to me then that this would be written late in life, when he has seen the vanity of how he has conducted himself as he left God, because he certainly did. One of the things that you'll find as a specific example is the interaction that Rehoboam had with the elderly advisors at Solomon's death. When he became a king, people came to him and said, you know, make our lives easier because we've been burdened by your father, and the taxes were oppressive. There was a lot of oppression of the little guy in Solomon's kingdom, And he gave they gave him counsel. Yeah, it was hard under your father, and if you'll make it easier, they'll love you, and they'll keep you the king. And he didn't. He said, you think it was bad under him, it's going to be worse under me. And that's why the kingdom was divided. So, yeah, I don't know that you would say hypocrisy there, but maybe that acknowledgement on his part, I've seen this, and the reason he had seen it is because he was in part responsible for a lot of what he's talking about. You wonder about that with the wisdom that Solomon had been given, the discernment that he had, how it's an indication again of will versus knowing. There are a lot of times in our lives to where we know what we're doing is wrong, we do it anyway, because we choose maybe the momentary enjoyment that we would receive, or because of some weakness of societal pressures or whatever the case may be, we do things we know we shouldn't do. But you have an individual who he had been given wisdom by God, and it was a discernment that was surpassed those of other men because it was divinely given, and yet he persisted in doing these evil, foolish things. And so you wonder what his mindset was, how torn he felt, and you know, it's out of that. And again, that dichotomy, that opposition forces that just tear us up inside. You can see it in his writing, in this book. It's just that in the end, he comes to the right conclusion.
I was going to say, but that, in a lot of ways, is our human wisdom. Because, I mean, you look at David against Goliath. Here's Goliath, a very strong man, he's a giant. But then here's David, but he had God on his side. So he overtook him, but he gave the glory to God. Where Solomon had all that wisdom, and the world kind of overtook Solomon. Because he forgot where that wisdom came from. And I think that's part. We get lost really quick. And like with giving the gospel, it's our job to give it to people, to present it to people. We can't make them accept it. Our failure is if we don't give it to them. It took me a long time to learn that. Because it's hard when you present it to people. But then I wasn't always a Christian. You present it to people and they don't take it. And you're like, how can you not see this? But we were, well, not all of us were raised in the church, but, you know, sometimes it's there for you whether or not you take it. It isn't our choice. We just have to do what we're told to do.
Anybody else? Next section, someone read for me verses 4 through 6.
Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool holds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind.
This one is especially interesting because it so well describes the society in which we live. And we as Christians get caught up in this. And I especially like that last verse, verse 6. It's better a handful of quietness than both hands full with toil and grasping. So someone is continually striving because he wants more. The pursuit of material gain, the pursuit of possessions is something that is continual. And people can literally ruin their lives and make themselves miserable because they don't have what someone else has, or they don't have what they perceive to be needful for them, when they have plenty. More than enough, more than the rest of the world has, typically. And if they would just have that ability to be content. I mean, if you look at the example of Paul, and of course I'm reminded of his words in the Philippian letter because he was in prison at the time. And it was at that time that he talked about how, you got me stuff and I appreciate it, but it's better for you that you got it for me than me, because I get the gift, you get the crown from that, you know. And he said, and if you hadn't sent me, I've been fine. I've learned to be, whether it's exalted or abased, to be content in whatever state I'm in. And that, well, that's a powerful thing, because even if we as Christians, we continually want something more, and typically the reason we want something more is because the previous thing that we wanted so badly, when we get it, doesn't give us the lasting satisfaction. So oh, I've got to have that. Oh, I've got it. Oh, isn't this wonderful? Oh, it's like we just have no attention span when it comes to enjoying our possessions. And it's something that's ingrained in us as a society. And that's why you have the littlest of children, and we all have this tendency with kids, grandkids. We want to shower them with gifts, let's say on Christmas or birthdays. And we want to get them these things. And when they're little, they could care less about them. You know, what's their joy? Everybody in the family's there, and we're having a blast, and we're playing, and you got the box. Yeah, that's difficult. And all. But then it doesn't take long before the child starts expecting things. And then if disappointment comes in, if they don't get what they were expecting to get, or they don't get as expensive a version of what they wanted as what they desire. And this is kind of a process that continues on and on and on and on and on in life. And it's a real danger that we see there. And it has to do not only with getting gifts and getting things, but also working hard. There is no end to all his labors. He's working so hard with regard to these things, stated in verse 8. But the other thing about it, and this is what he brings up, is the rivalry. Because there is that. It's the phrase "keeping up with the Joneses" is one that we're very familiar with, because it's cliche, but it's a typical thing in our world. We're happy with what we have, maybe some contentment with what we get, until we see someone else who has something better than we do, and then we want what they've got. And so there's that continual striving, and envy comes as a result of that. Envy, of course, is sinful, but envy again is an outgrowth of that selfishness. I want, and my needs are more important, and I would rather me have something than someone else have it. And so when he has it, it upsets me, and I want to get what he has, and those kinds of things. I think that as Christians, we have a good grasp of that, and we have a good understanding of it. I'm more concerned with the other aspects of this, although, again, envy is a sin, and we have to be careful and be aware that we can be guilty of it. But I'm more concerned about that verse 6. Not so much that you're envying someone else, but that just you can't be completely happy because you just have to work to get more. And the motivation of that is not always even necessarily a selfish thing. It may be that you feel the need to work harder to give, to have stuff to give to someone else, but that your whole life is striving and working, and you don't have enough, and you want to get more, and you're stressed, and you're focused on those kinds of things, when there are a lot of other people, and a lot of times they're considered to be lazy because they're not working hard. They don't have much, but they're very, very happy. I read an illustration of this, a story. It's made up, but they talk about a fisherman in somewhere in South America on the coast, and he goes out and fishes a couple times a day. A couple hours of each day, and he comes home, he's got his fish. And there's an American businessman that sees him. And he says, "Wow, that's a lot of fish you got." And he said, "It's enough to feed my family." "So how long are you out there?" "2 hours." "Well, what are you going to do now?" "So I'm going to go home and play with my kids. I'm going to visit with my wife. We're going to cook the feed and fish. We're going to take a nap, you know, this kind of stuff." So do you realize what you're missing out on here? If you were to work 8 hours a day, you could get more, you could sell it, you could buy a bigger boat, you could hire people, you could go up and all this kind of stuff. And he builds it up. And then, if you've got this built up, then you can retire. So what am I going to do then? So well, you can play with your kids, you can you can talk to your wife, you can take a nap, you know, those kinds of things. Well, I've already got that, you know. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. And that's very much American. You know, we gotta do bigger, better, and build, and boy, there have been so many benefits and positive things physically that have come as a result of such a drive. But there have been so many lives that have been ruined in that pursuit that, yes, they've done things that have been beneficial to the world, but they've been miserable in their own lives. Heart attacks and ulcers and strokes and cancer and cirrhosis of the liver and all these kinds of things as people deal with the pressures and stresses of life, because they're continually grasping instead of having contentment with what they have. And it's not just the titans of industry either, because you can have individuals who work manual labor that have that same kind of a striving where they're not satisfied with what they have. All right. Anyone to add about that? You'll notice in the second paragraph, he says the king noted two extremes regarding human behavior. One is the workaholic, the second is the lazy individual. And the answer lies in neither extreme. Verse 6 is that balance that we talked about. To be content with what you have. To work to obtain what you have, to be content with what you have, and not to be always striving for something that you can't have or something beyond. So, good point to be made there. I've got started those deals in Proverbs. They're good passages that help to illustrate this point. Proverbs 15, 16 and 17. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. And better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. And that's not a statement on the vegetarianism is better than an omnivore diet. It's an indication that a lot of people understand that meat is a lot more enjoyable than herbs. But the point there is that if you've got strife, then the dinner is not nearly as enjoyable as a simple salad would be.
You know. Could you not say, like, with the widow's mites, for how easily she could give up her means? It was all that she had, but it was, she gave it with no problem. Versus people who have, and I've seen this because I've cleaned houses for a lot of very wealthy people, they can be very, very stingy with things, and it always would frustrate me because they couldn't. Like, oh my, you have all this, yet it's so hard for you to give up yourself. So.
And a lot of the reason that a lot of people get rich is for that very reason. It's because of that selfishness and that miserliness. And there are a lot of rich people who are, I mean, from the stereotype of the Scrooge on down, that get where they are because of that very reason. They want to get, not willing to give at all. One of the interesting things, analog to that, I've seen a number of videos on the internet that show a man who, let's say you got a bum on the street, he's just down on his luck and such, and someone gives him $100, and it's basically two people, so he's got these $100. It's this one that I'm thinking of, I think it was $100 that the man gave him, and he immediately went and he bought some things that he needed. He went to the store and got him, because he lived on the street, got a blanket and things like that. And then it was a two-man crew that was doing this, and they were filming it just to see how he would respond. Because another guy sat down beside him, the bum, and started talking about what had just happened to him in his life, what he had lost, and he was just, you know, and this guy got up and immediately went. He said, "Stay right here." And he went and he returned his merchandise. And I don't remember if the guy needed a meal or something. But he wasn't as bad off as the guy on the street was, in the sense of he just had an acute need right then. And that guy who had just gotten this windfall, who really needed it badly, he sold it all, got the money, and helped the other one. And, of course, it was a ruse. They were just, but they let him know that we appreciate what you did and everything. This wasn't real, and here's the money, plus some extra in return, you know, and praise him for it. But the guy didn't have anything, and for him, and I think it had more to his character, because I think you could talk to you could have tried that on a bunch of other people, and they wouldn't have done it. But it was an idea of his character, and I think it may have been like the widow, is that you realize, as hard as life is, that you can have a life, and you can have that contentment and such without much. And she didn't have anything. She got two mites, which was a very little bit. But she gave it.
But it was all.
Yeah. It was all she had. And we in some ways have a hard time even fathoming. And I love the way Jesus put that. He gave more than all. She gave more than all because she gave all she had. And it's more proportion than it is that God cares
about things.
But we do that too. I mean, we think about our contributors and wow, you know, this particular individual, how much money they give and all. It has nothing to do with that.
I'll never forget PA. I remember talking to PA one time about how much do you give? Because I said, I battle with this. How much? And he said, well, if you think you've given enough, then you've not. And it made a lot of sense, because if you're satisfied in that, then you've not given. And it was that aha moment with me or whatever, but it was very simple, but it was very good advice. So.
Yeah. You know, the Fosters are among those, and there have been others in the congregation in the past. It's kind of an interesting thing. There have been times that I remember in our history to where there were certain things that were needful. So you had people who were giving sacrificially and giving. But then something comes up, and the one I think of is the auditorium had gotten so bad that where we needed to do something with the pews and all need to be refinished and the carpet put in, those kinds of things. And so the decision was made to do it. It's okay, but you know, this is going to be a big outlay, and it's, you know, we've got money in our treasury and these kinds of things. And it turned out that ended up being, you know, as much as these, and many of the ones who did this were the ones that were the biggest contributors in the congregation, you know, but they had that mindset, that sacrificial mindset, and so they dipped into their savings or dipped deeper in their pockets or whatever, and just all of a sudden money was, you know, a gigantic contribution one Sunday because somebody took care of it. And that willingness to do that is a neat thing. And again, it's an indication, again, of spiritual maturity. It's an indication of individuals who recognize that while it's important to have, and you use Piantippi as an example, they were very, you know, they weren't ostentatious at all. They were very, I mean, not saying they had lots and lots of money, but they were very careful with their money. They grew up in times where money was scarce, so they were
very frugal.
Frugal, thank you. I was trying to figure it out. I knew there was a word there that described very, very frugal in their actions. But whenever largesse was needed, then they were willing to do that. And there's a difference between frugality and miserliness. and there are some people that are miserly, and they certainly were not. And many others in the congregation were helpful in that regard as well. So that's the kind of attitude that we're supposed to have.
Sometimes we don't know the need, though.
Well, that's true. I don't think God holds us accountable when we don't know what the need is, but He certainly wants us to do what we can when we become aware of it. The other passage there, which Ted Chiu teaches, makes the same thing as 16:8 in Proverbs: better is little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. You're better off poor and right with God, ultimately, than to have a lot of money if you're not doing what's right. All right, and then the third of the three observations, and we'll have to wait until next week to talk about his way of dealing with these things. But the third is the personal disillusionment that is mentioned there in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verses 7 and 8. Who would like to read that for me?
I'll
do
it.
Okay.
Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a great misfortune.
So depressing.
Yes, that's why I say despair maybe be a little bit better than cynicism in regard to that. But the personal disillusionment here. And so he talks about, and again, this is a general application of what is said here, because he said, I saw one alone. So it's almost like Solomon has a particular individual in mind. And this particular individual didn't have anybody. He didn't have anybody to leave stuff to. And yet that still was his focus in life, is trying to get stuff. And so he basically wasted his life trying to gain and gather, never with the intention of actually taking advantage of what he gained and gathered. It was just to get it. And so he's miserable getting, so they'll have, and never benefits from the have, and never asks himself, why am I doing this? I love that part of it, and that expression is that he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? And that's, I think, again, a problem that you can see. So in a general concept, he talked about the success-driven person and how that's something that typically does not bring happiness, because individuals, And you'll hear people who say, I've learned that. And it's typically as they get older. When I was a youngster, I was a go-getter, and I'd worked hard to build this business, and I did this. Said, now I've understood that I wasn't enjoying myself. I was getting ulcers. I wasn't getting fulfillment out of it. Now I've decided to have less and to enjoy myself more and those kinds of things. So you hear those kinds of stories again and again and again. You hear them so often, you would think, okay, that's a lesson everybody should already know, because there are so many examples of these successful people who basically said, I really wasted a lot of my life trying to get, and I've learned that to have less and to enjoy what you've got. But people keep doing it over and over and over again. People are wired that way, and again, I think it is an outgrowth of societal pressures. And but the reasons why he's not happy is because he never slows down. There is no end to all his labors. He never has enough. His eye is not satisfied with riches, and he never asks why. Who am I going to do this, or who am I doing this for? So he makes the point on the top of the next page is that the happiest people are not necessarily the most prosperous of people. Now he gives a text from Luke chapter 12. And again, I circled that because I thought it was sufficiently helpful to note again that parable that Jesus stated in verses 13 through 20 of the rich fool. The idea or the reason for this being spoken was because there were individuals in Jesus' presence who were unhappy with regard to, they weren't getting what they thought they deserved. And so the one from the crowd said, Teacher, tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me. And his response was, instead of, okay, yeah, you need to do that, he said, beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist of the abundance of the things he possesses. That's not what life is all about. He talked about the rich man who fared sumptuously, tore down his barns, built greater. And in verse 19, he said, I will say to my soul, this is the rich man talking, I will say to my soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So the idea is, he worked so hard in his life to get to that point where he finally relaxed and his life was taken from him. So he wasted all that time because riches were what was important to him. And that's not what life is about. So that's a very important lesson that Jesus teaches us, and one that Solomon, I think, understood somewhat as well. So looking at the last paragraph and a half there, Jesus taught that true happiness and a life of peaceful contentment can only be had when you build your life around genuine relationships. God first, and then others as well. And then unless and until we do that, we will be empty and lonely, which is like Solomon was. We won't have that same end. And so Solomon saw all of those things. And again, it's lonely to be the king. And I think that he recognized that. And I think, again, that's why it was less cynicism and more despair. Look what I've built, look what I've done, but wasted all my life in this. So he felt that. All right. Comments, questions? That gets us then to the next section, which is point number 4, survival counsel. This is where the concept of friendship is emphasized and how much better it is to have someone to help you, which is kind of the beginning of the chapter as well. So I think we'll get a lot out of that section. That's where we'll pick up next time. Thank y'all for coming today.